Meeting will come to order. Let the record reflect that it is 8:04 a.m. Friday, January 28, 2001. And I'd like to ask the secretary to call roll.
Representative Wilson?
Here.
Representative Feige?
Here.
Here.
Representative Here. Representative Sisna? Representative Kawasaki?
Here.
Here. Okay, I'd like to remind everybody at this time, turn off cell phones, and that includes me. Also, I'd like to remind every one of us that even as we meet this morning, there's 129,000 students, K-12. They're getting ready for school today, 7,000 teachers, and that doesn't even cover the other people that we influence and as part of the education committee, and that I really believe the decisions we're making today and during this session are really going to impact those people down the road. Maybe not today, but it's going to impact them down the road. And I think what we have here is maybe a serious responsibility, but it's also a wonderful opportunity to really take a creative look at what we're doing in education and just how we can make it happen better. First item today, one thing I'd really like to do is this state is huge, and I've traveled to many, many villages across the state, and I haven't been to half of them yet. So every meeting we're going to ask a superintendent from a different school district to give us a 5 to 10 minute presentation, and basically what's unique about your district, what does the superintendent want us to know about what's unique in that location. So today, Mr. Rob Thomason, superintendent of Petersburg School District, yes, one of Representative Wilson's schools, is going to give us a presentation on Petersburg. Mr. Thomason, would you introduce yourself and explain where Petersburg is located? And then feel free to take 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes, as to what you want us to know about Petersburg and how you're unique on the face of the earth.
Why, sure. Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you. Petersburg, just south of you in Juneau, we have 500 of your 129,000 youngsters in the state, 46 of that 7,000 teachers. We're predominantly a fishing village, largely of Norwegian descent, recognized one of the top fishing ports in the United States, population about 3,000, swells to 4,000 when the fishing season kicks into gear. We mild winters, cool summers, year-round rainfall about 106 inches. When I say mild winters, that's compared to the interior. We do not experience the negative 50 that I experienced when I was in Nenana there, so those bring unique issues and problems to those school districts. Transportation to and from Petersburg. There is no road, as many places in Alaska. It's all by air or by water, Alaska ferry or float plane. We have very strong community support, community attendance at participation in school events. Most of our events are packed. We're the only gig in town 90% of the time, our sports, our plays, our music performances, our special meetings. We had a couple of local bond issues passed recently prior to my arrival, a neat swimming pool and a roof for an elementary school. Petersburg High School was recently recognized by U.S. News and World Report as a silver medal school. The only high school in Alaska to receive that. They also received an exemplary program award from Apple Computer. We have a one-to-one laptop initiative and a real strong emphasis on digital learning. That was given to only 40 schools in the nation this year. And Stedman Elementary in 06 was recognized as a Blue Ribbon School, as was the school, I think, in Wrangell this year. Congratulations, Representative Wilson. That's quite an honor. And I had sent some written documentation. I'm assuming and hoping you have that in front of you. I just need an overview of the paragraph on top there. Can I just confirm you have that with you?
Yes.
Yeah, yes, we do.
Okay. And all the numbers at the bottom, I won't bother going over those. We do have an overall budget of $7.5 million. And I'm very proud of our music program, our voc ed program, our art program. We have AP courses. and a very strong special ed program. In terms of our uniqueness, I think our uniqueness is that we are an island, as are many, and that brings, you can be an island surrounded by water or an island surrounded by land, as many school districts in Alaska are. I would like to take you, if you have access to our website there?
I believe we do. Let's give it a try, sir.
Okay. Just so you can see who you're speaking to, if you're on our website, and that little photo on the front is pretty representative. That's one of our harbors with the ever-present cloud bank. If you drop down from district home to superintendent, just so you can see who you're talking to, I have all your photographs here, so it's kind of nice to know who you're talking to. So if you go there, that's who is on the other end with you. And then from there, if we drop down to district back up to district information, what you will find with many school districts, and some of you may be new to the committee, but there's a federally required report card every district creates. We have the district report card and the school report cards, and it's one way of comparing data in a similar format on all school districts. And if under Petersburg District Report Card you clicked on the 2009-210, it should bring up a PDF document. And that's what it would look like for every school district. And if one were to dig deeper into performance data, and we're quite proud of ours, by the way, that's what you would find. So Sheila, if you can go up and click the back button to take us out of there, should go back to the Petersburg City Schools district information page. And then if we drop down to focus on success, kind of give you an overview. We are unique in that our size is small. Our community is very supportive. We are blessed in that we do not have some of the issues of other
Excuse me, can we pause a second? We're
Sheila, sure. In that big box, second from the bottom.
Oh, focus on success. Yeah, it's in the blue box, second from the bottom. It should have some boxes on it. It'll say high school Spanish class, elementary digital stories, that kind of thing.
I think it's
asking to install an app.
Huh?
It's asking to install an app.
We don't.
It needs an app.
Yeah, it needs a.
We don't have the app, I guess.
Install an add-on.
Okay, not a big deal. What you would have seen would have been a high school Spanish class. I'm going to describe it to you just so you can get a picture. We have AP classes. We have AP Spanish here, so we're quite proud of our foreign language program. They did a little deal on the Angry Gingerbread Man, and it was all in Spanish, and they did it against a green screen where they created their background. We have digital, elementary digital stories. Our youngsters in the elementary school weave in multiple subjects, the writing, the reading, the problem solving, digital applications, literary style, and art, all into digital projects. It's the day of the sitting in rows and those are the textbook, those are gone, and that's why digital infrastructure, technology infrastructure is so important throughout the state of Alaska. So that pretty much is an overview. I do not want to overstay my time. We are quite proud of what we have here, and we're proud of being part of the Alaskan system and all the other schools we're able to work with. And I guess I have a minute or two if you have a question. I would love to entertain a couple.
Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Wilson.
I don't have a question, but I really thank you for presenting this to us today, and I'm just very proud of my schools, and Petersburg is right up there on my list.
Well, thank you. I hope it was what you needed. Sheila was very helpful in telling me what to do, and I'm sure as you progress through this procedure with other superintendents, it'll become better defined, and I didn't want to go over all the data. I mean, you can read that, and it's all right there in front of you with the numbers. So I wanted to tell you about our kids, because that's what it's all about.
Well, thank you. Oh, excuse me, Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Superintendent, for coming on. You know, I'm just looking over the facts that you gave us, and I see you have 87.5 graduation rate, which is very good. You mentioned the Silver Meadow School. If there is one thing that you could leave us with that you are doing there that we might be able to take back or utilize, what would that be?
The fact that Petersburg is a leader and tends to remain a leader in the digital literacy focus. We are small enough that we are light on our feet, and when something comes along that is great for kids, we can move quickly to implement that. So I would think that it's just we're putting a lot of time, effort, and funding into digital literacy technology in the hands of teachers and students and family. And I guess that would be the thing that you remember, that our shining star that we hang our hat on is digital literacy.
Well, thank you. I think that's great. It kind of goes along with, I think, some things we've talked about here that you might not have heard. So thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you for the question.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question, I know Petersburg a while back had broadband problem getting out and pixelating and those kind of things. Has that been resolved for Petersburg, or do you still have the same kind of that problem, and how do you get around it if you do?
You know, it has been totally and completely resolved. GCI has been outstanding. We have fiber to the island, and in fact the entire island is high-speed broadband. When I leave the island and I go stay in hotels and stuff, I can't wait to get back home because it's faster here.
Well, I appreciate that, and if you hear of how those that don't have the broadband connection that you do are solving the problem, we would appreciate you forwarding that to us as well.
I would be happy to, and those are issues. You're correct. We're a huge state, and those are issues in districts. You're a very good question.
One more.
Excuse me, Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Rob, tell me... all the kids in the high school have computers, right?
Correct. We were 6 years ago, we were happily the recipients of the AASB one-to-one laptop initiative. That has since expired. It's for a three-year deal. And we are, that's why I say focus on that. We are continuing that. Every youngster, when they hit ninth grade, we have what we call the rollout. And it's quite an event. Everybody gets a brand new Apple computer. They have it for 4 years. And that they take it to class with them when they travel on the ferries. They have access to their classes. We use something called Moodle. There is no excuse for not being up to date when you're a student at Petersburg High School.
Rob, can I follow up?
Excuse me, follow up.
Those kids that leave and go on to college, is there, what's the possibility of them taking the computers with them?
They are open. They can purchase it. I think we sell them for between $100 and $200, depending on a very minimal cost. The downside of that is that we often encourage them not to, but they're welcome to. By the time that computer is 4 years old and been in high school, the next generation is out, and they need something a little more powerful for college.
Okay.
So we find that our seniors are always coveting the freshmen's computers.
Well, Superintendent Thomason, really appreciate you doing this. This is the first. We're going to do many more, but we couldn't have had a better presentation. And Google Earth really helped us here. So if you have any additional thoughts throughout the session that you'd like to send us one way or another, our ears are open. It looks like you certainly have part of the model for success, and we'll probably be looking to you later on. So thank you, sir.
Bless you. We look forward to hearing from you. And again, thanks to Sheila. She was the conduit. Did an awesome job, Sheila. So I guess we're signing off now, and have a great meeting.
Okay. Thank you. And for the record, I'd like to mention that Representative Sisson is here. And if we could have Cindy Kern, Director of Teaching and Learning Division, come forward with anybody you'd like to have join you. And I just like to say that when I sat in the Talking Book Library about 3 weeks ago Cindy showed up, I was just thrilled. I've known Cindy for decades, and we've just done... Oh, we are that old, dear. So,
what did 2 years.
So anyway, just wonderful to have you here. Wonderful to have you here. So if you would like to get us up to speed on the topic, and just feel free.
Good morning, Representative Dick and the members of the House Education Committee. My name is Cindy Curran, and I am the Director for Teaching and Learning Support at the Department of Education and Early Development. Prior to going to the department, I taught in the state of Alaska and the state of Arizona for, let's just say, over 20 years. So really, it has been decades, I guess.
Morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eric McCormick, and I'm the Director of Assessment, Accountability, and Information Management at the department. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I went to elementary school at Capital School up the hill. Mm-hmm. We will start off here with one of your handouts that we have is labeled Alaska Department of Education and Early Development Graduation Working Group. And I will go over first the overview and purpose of our group and how it's evolved over the brief couple of years. Doesn't seem like a brief couple of years, but back in November of 2009, our former commissioner brought together Alaskans from all over the state. I can't even name all the entities that they represented, but it was to put together our education plan, which is a blueprint for our public education system. And one of the topics we had was world-class students, and out of the world-class students and all the conversations we had about how to produce a world-class student, we came up with this graduation working group. And initially, we really did focus in the first couple meetings on high school. What can we do to retain kids in high school and to keep them engaged? And we found very quickly that we were limiting ourselves in our conversations. So we worked our way down into the middle school level, elementary level, all the way down to pre-K and even before pre-K. And we were honored to have Chairman Dick at our last meeting. We've also been joined with Representative Seaton. Previously we had Representative Book and Representative Gardner. And I will let Cindy in a minute go over the rest of the membership. But one thing we talked about over and over was the need for kids to be engaged and to connect with an adult. And often that was enough to keep the kids going to school, was just making that connection. Another document I want to share with you, we started off each meeting, and we met two or three times a year in Anchorage. And there is a document labeled graduation rates and dropout rates, definitions and data. And graduation rate would, we could talk about that all day in our graduation working group committees, but we always started off with the focus of what the numbers were. You can see here I gave a history of the last 6 years that we've calculated the graduation rate. And in Alaska, what we do for accountability, we're required to measure the percentage of kids that get through in 4 years. So this measures, when you see for 2010, that 67.7% of our kids graduated, that means in a four-year window. So that does not incorporate kids who came back for their fifth year or their sixth year. And you can see, if you look back at 2005, our graduation rate was 61.4. The count of kids receiving regular diplomas was 69.05. In 2010, graduation rate up again to 67.7. We issued 8,245 diplomas, regular diplomas to kids. So we're now graduating 1,300 more kids than we did 6 years ago. And this is in a time when our enrollment has been flat. So I think this is significant. You don't see as much of the graduation rate again because of the four-year nature, but you do see that the number of kids receiving diplomas has raised significantly.
Mr. Chairman. Oh, excuse me, Representative Sisna.
Yeah, real quick question. Do we have the number of students enrolled that could go along with this? Because this is great information, need to know the total we're talking about.
Okay. To the chair, Representative Sisna, we could easily provide that. We start off with about 10,000 ninth graders, and we end up with about 8,000 graduates. But that's easy for me. I can contribute that to the group.
Okay. Representative Faye.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One question on your graduation rate. The 67%, is that kids that have gone to all 4 years, or does it account for folks that may have moved either moved out of the district or moved into the district partway through those 4 years?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, that would be the we're actually going to a new method this school year where we are measuring kids in a cohort. Starting, we identify them as a freshman, a first-year freshman, and then they have 4 years. And then we do adjust it if they transfer in or out. The previous, these 6 years represent a formula that we used that actually did a, it utilized aggregate counts of dropouts. When we first came up with the need to do graduation rate, we didn't have access to student-level data, so we couldn't track individual students. So these graduation rates presented here for 2005 through 2010 was a collection of aggregate counts with dropouts. So it was a loose, it was the best way we could, but until we had student level data, this is the best way that we could produce these rates. But it is a measure of 4 years, and we do adjust it as students transfer in or out of the state.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. The next rate I want to go over is the dropout rate. And the point I want to make here is that we calculate our dropout rate as a single year event rate. So when you see here in 2010, we had a dropout rate of 5%. That means of all the kids, that represents of all the kids in grades 7 through 12, what percentage of them dropped out within a 12-month window. And we do adjust it if the kids return. So if a kid drops out, if they return in a reasonable amount of time, if they drop out and they miss a significant amount of time, we work with the districts to see whether it's appropriate to count that as a dropout. But if the kid takes a week off, or off in the weekend, we'll get a dropout event on a Friday, and then we find the kid changes his mind and re-enrolls on a Monday. We don't count that as a dropout statistic. We also find that about 20 to 25% of the kids that are counted each year as a dropout are multiple dropouts. They've been counted in previous years. And so I do want to point out to this committee that the graduation rate and the dropout rates are reported separately from each other. So,
Representative Sisna.
Thank you. This is super valuable information. I know through the years I've been involved with the schools in various ways, volunteer and that kind of thing. And I remember very well about a decade, well, more than a decade ago, that it appeared that we were having serious, serious problems with dropouts, and that there were serious problems with really even knowing where the kids came from and where they go. They just sort of are there and then they're not there anymore.
Right.
And one, I'd like to know if that kind of thing is being tracked in terms of trying to figure out where they come from and where they go. And two, are we keeping count of the total amount of, whether or not, and this doesn't really show directly unless I'm reading it wrong, if we're really in a downward mode, or are we in terms of fewer dropouts, because that's the way it looks. It looks really good. But if our school population is dropping, it would mean one thing. If it's increasing, it would mean another.
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, that one thing that has significantly helped our ability to track kids as they drop out are the student management systems that districts are developing. Several districts actually spend the time to track down each individual. If they have not received a transcript request, they will actually try and locate the family. It's always going to be a challenge in Alaska because we have such a transient, mobile population. I would say that some of the improvements in our dropout rate are probably due to better reporting tools and the ability to find the kids. We're always looking for ways to improve that.
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, we're also working with the Department of Labor to do a match between the students that drop out and those that may come back and get their GED.
Good. Yeah,
thank you, Cindy.
Excuse me, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Eric, you know, this is really appreciated. However, I think most everybody is having the more detailed questions that our analysis isn't going to answer for a few years. And I was wondering if you would forward to the committee that Anchorage School District Memorandum, I think it's 96, which is a very detailed cohort study that started in, I think it was 2002, and they looked at every individual student, and they tracked them through. You can see in that report when kids dropped out, and it's amazing that most of them, the majority, dropped out before the age of 16. And, you know, just, I think it was 58%. But there's so much detail that, you know, we're trying to get our hands around here, and we don't have the statewide data yet, but that was a very detailed, very well done study that was carried on for 5 years. And so I just wanted to make sure that, you know, if you could provide that, along with your comments, you know, on that report, and it can be in writing to me, but I think that would be very helpful to us.
Okay. To the chair, Representative Seaton, we'd be happy to find that, and I'm excited to see what we can find. Now that we do have the data, it would be exciting to track those kids. But as Ms. Curran mentioned, working with Department of Labor has opened up new data for us to view. We also have access now to kids who have who are pursuing GEDs and who receive GEDs, and that's been very powerful information as well. Unfortunately, for our federal reporting, we are not allowed to count kids who receive a GED as a regular diploma. So these graduation counts do not include students who have received a GED.
For the record, Cindy Curran. I'm going to talk a little bit about the membership of the committee. When the Alaska Summit on Education happened in 2009, many people from all over the state were there, and the committees had great attendance. World-class schools was a huge committee. It was broken down into outcomes. From that, there was a group of people who wanted to continue on looking at what's going on in our state with dropouts and graduation rate. So this committee was formed. In the beginning, it was a little bit hard to get high school students involved, but as it evolved, we were able to get high school students from Anchorage, Bering Strait, and Sitka. We were able to get high-achieving students to give us their input, as well as students who had maybe moved from rural to urban and back to rural. We also had input from students who were not high achievers. We've had, if you look on your handout, you could see that we've had membership from the Governor's Council. We've had high school principals, and we've had district superintendents to give us their information also. Cook Inlet Tribal Council gave us a lot of information on opportunities that they were providing for students. Anchorage's Promise, I don't know if you're aware, is affiliated with America's Promise, and it is a group. America's Promise is very devoted to increasing graduation rates and preventing dropouts. Communities and Schools, which lost its funding, did have membership on that committee. University of Alaska Statewide was able to provide all of us information on what happens on the transition between high school and college and help us to understand what the university system was about. We were fortunate that people from other state agencies such as the Department of Corrections, Department of Health and Social Services gave their time to give their perspective on issues and what happens when students drop out. As Eric mentioned before, we had members of the House Education Committee prior, and Representative Seaton joined us. And then we have a member from the State Board of Education and Early Development. So we have a broad base of membership, and as you can imagine, the conversations that we have go all over the board. So it's very interesting, and we're all learning a lot from each other. And now Eric's going to talk about our working group goals.
Thank you. I also wanted to mention that when we did have the students there, they were amazed, really, at that adults were sitting around in a room talking about kids' futures. They were really engaged in that, and we expected them to be a little bit nervous and waiting for them to come out of their shell. That wasn't the case at all. They had things to say
right away,
and we listened, and we did hear from. We had kids not just from traditional high schools, but we had alternative high school kids, and their experiences, what kids are going through now, is completely different than what many of us probably went through. The exposure they have to things that didn't probably exist when we were kids. So I'm trying not to date myself now. So our working group goals, again, back up. What we would typically do before a meeting as we were putting together the meeting agendas, we would find different literature and different studies, and we try and focus that and break our groups up to have discussions, typically around engagement, student engagement, and we looked at what other schools and what other states are doing and what type of tools they were developing. And often some of this literature came from House Education Committee members, which we appreciate. We also, our initial meeting, we broke our conversations into community, student, school, and family. And we kind of moved away from that because we realized how they all overlapped so much that we didn't want to focus just on one of the four. We kept our conversations to include all four. Identifying the cultural uniqueness of our kids. I know we talked in Anchorage and Fairbanks about them serving up to 100 languages and the challenges of kids as they're coming in. We talked about the Hmong community up in Anchorage and some of the challenges of getting families to be involved and some of the cultures they came from and the different values of education. And that was fascinating to hear. As someone who's lived in Alaska my whole life, that there's a whole world out there several worlds I hadn't seen. One of the things, so I don't want to get into Cindy's part here. We had three districts provide to us analysis that they did as far as identifying early warning systems and dropout prevention programs that they have in place, but I think we're going to get into that here in a minute. Mm-hmm. Cindy? Oh, I'm sorry, yes, I did miss that. Our goals specifically were to improve connectedness and flexibility, again, engagement with our students. We heard from some ideas as simple as having an adult greet kids at the door, how important it was for a kid to realize that an adult in the school knew their name and recognized them. And often that was enough. We heard testimony from kids that said that just connecting with one person in the school once a day, that was enough to keep them coming. Another goal we had was to increase our community partnerships and build the relationships to eliminate some of the barriers to learning. Spent a lot of time on reasons for why kids drop out, and typically it wouldn't be one reason, it would be a cumulative collection of reasons, and it would just be, it could be anything that could finally lead to them dropping out. Also, we wanted to evaluate some of the pre-service and certification coursework requirements on multicultural and Alaska studies to assist the staff in being prepared to help these kids with some of the unique cultural responsive needs as our population is changing. It definitely is changing.
So moving on to the accomplishments of the group, when you're sitting in a committee, you oftentimes wonder what you're getting accomplished. Good conversations, but sometimes you can't see the forest for the trees. So it was good for me to be able to sit down and think about what we actually have accomplished. I think one of the most powerful things that the committee did was to share what everyone was doing and create a knowledge base of what school districts, students themselves, different community agencies were doing, because there are many, many groups that are addressing this problem, trying to make things better for our students. We began an examination and an analysis of procedures that disenfranchise students. What we mean by that is there are lots of reasons why students drop out of school. And some of them could be as simple as they don't like the building they're in. It doesn't meet their needs. the way courses are scheduled don't meet their needs. We heard that lack of transportation for extended day or after-school activities caused students to want to drop out. We heard that participation fees for these same activities were a barrier to students being engaged and thus wanting to come to school. Attendance policies often affect whether or not a student drops out, and the whole issue of retention. So there are many things that contribute to this, and the committee looked at some things and thought about what was going on, and all of these are being addressed in various ways in various communities. We also, as Eric mentioned, focused on the Alaska studies and the multicultural requirements for teachers in order to have teachers who would be culturally responsive and understand the needs of the students that they're serving. I can tell you that as I was the liaison between this group and the Teacher Quality Working Group, that the Teacher Quality Working Group has met and taken the recommendations that the High School Graduation Working Group gave them, and we've started looking at how to make the Alaska Studies coursework more relevant to what's happening in schools today so that teachers are prepared to meet their students' needs. That includes looking at alternative ways for teachers to be able to meet those requirements. We also, in the department, have a partnership liaison, and her role has been to work with communities and families and other organizations to bring them into the education system. We're all in this together. She, with RuralCap, the department has partnered, and we have something called the Middle School Partnership Program. It's in three districts, Lower Yukon, Bering Strait, and Fairbanks, and it involves six middle schools. There have been a series of community cafes where the community comes together to discuss what's happening in their middle schools and what they can do to increase student engagement. They've been very positively received, and we're hoping to have some information later on regarding what's happened with middle schools. I'm sure you all have seen this. The Raising a Graduate, this poster was created by the committee, has been distributed throughout the state. We have more. We're happy to distribute more. There's also work that's being completed on a link on our website, Every Student a Graduate. And we're hoping to provide resources for students, families, teachers, and others who are interested in increasing student success and increasing graduation rates. We're going to have ideas for resolving issues, many that came from the committee, others from outside sources, to try and help resolve issues that disenfranchise students. We're also going to be providing information regarding early warning signs for students at risk of dropping out. You have a handout from the Institute of Education Sciences, and this is part of the U.S. Department of Education. There are six recommendations for dropout prevention. They've classified them into diagnostic, targeted, or school-wide. And you can see that we in Alaska have been working on some of these things. Utilizing data systems that support realistic diagnosis of the number of students who drop out and that help identify individual students at high risk of dropping out. Fairbanks has developed dropout indicators. Anchorage has in their dashboard on their assessment reporting system, they have reports that can be generated about at-risk students. Another recommendation is assign adult advocates to students at risk of dropping out. You heard from Eric that students said that it was important for them to connect with an adult, someone who cares about them during the day. Kodiak has advisories, as does Kenai. I believe that last year this committee heard information about those two programs. Fairbanks has something called advisories for interventions, and Anchorage has graduation coaches. There are probably other things going on at various levels to help students connect with folks. It doesn't have to be just in high school. This can be middle school. It can be elementary school. Sometimes kids get it in their head they don't want to be something when they grow up in elementary school. So it's important that we have everyone involved in helping students realize their importance and what their futures can be. Provide academic support and enrichment to improve academic performance. The department is working on response to instruction and intervention, and that's commonly referred to as RTI. It's a way all students receive instruction. Those students that need help receive targeted interventions, and then you move up the scale to helping them acquire the content knowledge through response to instruction. Implement programs to improve students' classroom behavior and social skills. Response to instruction also does that, but the department has a pilot with CESA that is positive behavior interventions and supports. We're excited about the things that are going on. I believe there are six schools that are implementing this. We just received a report about what's going on. There is much work to be done with this. Personalizing the learning environment and instructional process. I'm sure that you all have heard of schools within schools. I mentioned developing early warning signs of dropping out. We are looking at the development of a statewide virtual learning network, and we're in the very early stages of that. Providing rigorous and relevant instruction to better engage students in learning and provide the skills needed to graduate and the skills they need to serve them after they graduate when they go into their careers. EED has content coaches who are available to work with teachers and districts so that they can better develop ways for students to access content. We have begun the review of our content standards and grade level expectations, and we are currently identifying tools to integrate cultural standards into instruction.
Excuse me, if I can interrupt, sure. I had a couple of thoughts while you were speaking. One thing, you know, let me give an example, and I'll mm-hmm. I'll apply it in another place. For many years, Ron and Susie Scullin at the university mentioned that we all noticed that when non-natives and natives speak, that native people seem to pause longer than white people, non-native people. And I always wondered why. You know, I come from the East Coast, and so conversation is kind of like a Chinese ping pong match, you know, really quickly. And I didn't understand why. And it wasn't until Rachel Craig, an elder from Nome or Kotzebue area, explained that to me. She said that long ago, once people started warring with each other, there was no way to stop the wars. And so people were trained to pause and think very carefully about what you're going to say so that it doesn't provoke somebody else. You know, you think very carefully. You don't want to be provocative. And so many, many generations after those, hundreds of years after those wars, many people just instinctively just pause. They take that pause, not knowing why it's happening. It's just that's how we do it here. Well, I'd like to apply that same concept that when I was first came to Alaska, in typical non-native way, I said to a person, one of the guys, oh, what are you going to do this fall? And it was almost like I'd hit him. It was almost like I struck him. And he's, and I stepped back and I pondered that. And And finally, years later, I put the pieces together, and I think I mentioned before the book Uyurok, The Way of the Human Being by Harold Napoleon, and he described the great death, you know, that came to the villages where whole villages were wiped out. Sometimes one or two children were left out of a village. And out of that great death, I don't know what preceded that, but out of that great death came the attitude that if you even assume that you're going to live to next fall, you're being presumptuous. And so for many in the villages, it was almost culturally inappropriate to say, I will do this in the fall. Do you understand? So I think, again, using the analogy with the language, people now are maybe intentionally not planning for the future, not knowing why, not realizing that, okay, we've recovered from that, and, you know, it is no longer presumptuous. You probably will be here in the fall, where before it was an offense to say, I will do this in the fall. So as I've thought through all of this and why kids aren't succeeding, and I tell kids, you got to have a vision. You got to have a vision for where you're going, because sometimes it gets really tough, and you've got to have that vision to carry you through to the end. That I really believe that part of getting, particularly the Native people, to transition here, we need the elders to say, not only is it important, you know, you must have a personal vision. It's okay to have a personal vision. I think we need to just get over that lack of understanding as why we're not talking about the fall and the future, and to have the elders in the villages validate it is good to have a personal vision. That was one thought I had. I think that's really important to get the young Native people engaged, because we do have some difficult times in education where you just got to fight your way through that physics class, even if you don't like physics. Representative Feige.
I'd just like to say, Mr. Chairman, that pretty much syncs with my experience from 5 years of flying folks around in the bush. In a lot of cases, it's sort of a superstition. You start planning ahead for the future, it's generally considered bad luck. And again, that's one of those sort of cultural things that most of your teachers are Caucasian. They come from outside Alaska when they start out in the bush. And that's certainly something to integrate in your training. As he also said, it's to make any kind of headway with especially educating the natives, you have to get the buy-in of the native elders. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just the chairman, Andrew Harris. Yeah. It is true.
Yeah. Thank you. And a lot of, Representative Sisson.
Well, I'm joining because I think that if, in fact, we're talking about actually as a committee getting something actually changed, the only way that we can really do that is to have in mind more than a 2 or 4 year plan. We have to have the long term plan. And I agree with both the chair and Representative Fay, and in that elders need to be brought into this. And they didn't quite say this, but what we have is we followed people who lived here for many, many thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And they did educate, and it was the elders that educated. And what Harold Napoleon was talking about was the diseases that really have wiped out a lot of that wisdom and a lot of the memory, but there's still some there, and the elders are the ones that have the most. And did in your work group, do you have elders involved?
To the chair, Representative Sisna, that's a great question, because we did not have any elders that I would identify as an elder, but we did talk about the need in communities to find those cultural leaders and have them involved in the schools. We also did talk about in many American Indian cultures, silence is valued. It's a virtue. It really is. And I think in continuing work with this to try and identify elders, that would be be a great possibility to have them there. But the conversations we have had is in the communities to get the elders involved.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we have to be very careful because, you know, somebody came in and told me that this is what I had to do, and I was an elder. You know, we have to be very careful how we do this because it's very easy to take offense at that, you know. So I think we have to be careful how we do it. But I asked Reggie Jewell one time, this has been quite some time ago, and I said, help me understand your culture and your way of life. And he said, that's almost impossible. But he said, I would like you to read a book. And he gave me a very, very thin book, and I can't tell you the name of it because the title is in a native language. But it was a book written by someone, a native, and they told in this book that about during the influenza epidemic in the 1919 and 1920, that so many of the villages were just wiped out, and just very few survived, and it was so traumatic for the people that survived. It was like shell shock for people that experienced something like that. And they lost their parents, they lost their aunts, their uncles, their grandparents, kids. And so the ones that survived really couldn't even talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so as they had children, or the children that were left, they couldn't talk because they were so devastated. And so they all learned to observe and learn from the observation. And in that process of learning through observing, because they were so devastated that there were no psychologists, there was no one to help them through this. And so that was also communications changed then, where they probably were much different before that influenza, because if you go back and read about that, half the earth died during that time. Mm-hmm. And so what you learn from observing the next generation, that's how you learned, and so you do it, and the next generation, I do things that my mother did. I don't even know why I do it, but my mom did it. That's the way we always did it, and so that's the way we did it. And it's a little bit something like, this is the way my mom always fixed the ham, and she always cut this end off, and so finally someday somebody said, well, how come mom always cut the end off? Because the pan wasn't big enough. We don't always know why we do the things that we do, but we do them because that's the way we were raised. And so there are reasons and how to, those are challenges that we face nowadays, but we have to realize that what the challenges are and then try to work so that we can meet the challenges. And that means for every one of us, it's a little bit different. For each student that's learning, it's a little bit different. And it doesn't matter where you're from, it's a little bit different. And so that means the teachers are, it's a big challenge for teachers in the schools, because whether there's a single mom raising the kids, and that's all over the place, you know. I was a single mom raising three children, and I was, when I was divorced, I didn't know anybody else that was divorced except one person at that time. And so we all have challenges that the kids go to school with that are different. And so we have to learn to figure out what the real reason is, and try to help the kids learn around those situations, and whether it's domestic violence or whether it's you can't sleep at night for because you're worried about your parents, and so you fall asleep every day at school. I mean, there's just tons of reasons. And so it doesn't even matter which culture it is, because we have so many of them nowadays. Mm-hmm. And so I just put that forward, because we don't really know why, for a lot of reasons, but we have to try to meet all those needs.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
As Ms. Curran mentioned, some of the information we heard from one of our students, we had a student who had moved around quite a bit. She had been in rural areas. She was born in a rural area. She'd moved her way up through Southeast. But one of the things that she did notice as an early teenager was she never said that one community valued education more. She did point out that they all had varying degrees of values in their education. I mean, this is a young teenager who knew this through her experience, and everywhere she went was different. And I think we were just as amazed at her level of awareness, and that's exactly true. She was exposed to so many different mm-hmm. things, and through that, she came up with her own value system on education. Yeah. And she's still with us.
I think this topic here, I bet we could spend 2-3 weeks. I mean, we wish we were on that same committee. And so in the interest of time, let's move on. But let's do plan to get back, and because every one of us is pretty passionate. That's why we're here, is we just want to make it better. So.
Chair Dick, in closing, our next steps, as you know, our commissioner will begin work on February the 3rd. Mm-hmm. We plan to meet with him to go over what's been accomplished by the group and to get direction from him on the next steps for the work.
Mm-hmm. What I wonder if it would be possible, we have the reasons why kids dropped out. You know, we had, Cindy, you mentioned, schedule, transportation, and all of those. If we could get some idea of maybe a list of them and maybe some idea of priority. I mean, I'm sure most of the kids didn't drop out because of participation fees. I mean, the kids in the village didn't even have anything to participate in, and they're still dropping out. I think I mentioned one of the previous meetings. I was in a village where one of the villagers said that most people can't remember the last graduate. So... participation fees wasn't an issue there. I think it would help all of us to have an idea of, the list of reasons why the students gave that they dropped out. And I know as a teacher myself, one of the most, if a student wants to hurt a teacher, there's one word that can just drive a dagger into your heart, and that's the word boring. When the kids say it's boring, you just, as a teacher, you just cringe, because you're just trying to make it as interesting and engaging as possible. And so the students know how to use that word, and they know how to twist that knife, you know, they really do. But at the same time, sometimes it's genuine. Sometimes it is boring. And I think at the crux of the whole engagement issue, I think if it's engaging, I mean, they'll walk 3 miles to the movie in the rain, you know, if it's engaging. And so transportation isn't an issue there. Or I'll go to the walk to the mall, even if it's snowing. So as we could talk about the negatives about, why aren't they going there? But then we could talk about what would cause them to be engaged. Did you indicate that this is the sum of what you had to say here today? Because I'd like to ask more questions if you're done.
Chair Dick, we're open for questions now, but okay. That's what we had brought to talk about.
Wonderful. Okay. Any questions from the committee? Representative Sisna.
One last thing, and that is over the 13 years that I've been serving here, speaking of being, I haven't been bored. That's not what's happened in my experience here. But discouraged is something that kind of comes out of it, and that's seeing the same levels, or maybe in some cases worse, some cases a little better, but nothing really substantial in terms of health and education. And the things that are affecting our youngest Alaskans, the growing Alaskans, and the challenges that they're facing in the big picture are much worse than there were 13 years ago. And I'm sitting where we have enormous power. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't feel like it. It doesn't feel like it. It feels like the power is somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, what I know is, in just personally, is that there are ways to get things done. There are ways to change things. But what it takes is your groups of people that don't give up. And oftentimes, the groups of people that can't be stopped, and politically you can stop things by rules. And somehow, if we really want to change the future here, what I believe we have to do is allow sustainability by putting things in that make sure that groups exist past political changes. And we really need to somehow rise above what drives us a lot to make sure that we're giving these kids what all children need, and that is solid, steady, never give up. And groups that exist for them that really give that feeling are really important too, besides the one individual that they bond with and that stands behind them alone. We need to have that. Do you think about that? Because I have a feeling the way you've been looking at this, there's been a lot of thoughts. And about sustainability, do you have any recommendations?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, we did talk about the importance of kids being exposed to risk. And it's something with activities. It takes some courage to get up in front of people and do anything. Sustainability, I don't have any recommendations off the top of my head. Ms. Curran?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, I just want to make sure I understand the question around sustainability. Did you mean the sustainability of the group's work trying to prevent dropouts?
That and more.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Sisna. As budgets shrink, we all face a variety of realities. However, when the group met last, one of the things that we did discuss was different ways that we could still come together using technology so that our work can continue. And through the technology, we could probably involve more people to get out and learn what's going on in various places, through the website to spread the word. So we plan to continue in some form or fashion into the future. Everyone that's involved in that group is very passionate about what we're doing, and nobody wants to give up. The task can seem daunting, but I think the people who are involved realize that we can't give up on our future, and so we'll figure out what we need to do in order to sustain it.
Thank you. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess in my life experience, I've worked for or been a part of many organizations. Mm-hmm. Organizations that are basically clubs, businesses, military units, and just, you know, family organizations. All those organizations had issues one way or the other, and some worked effectively and some didn't. Some of the things that didn't work effectively, it was interesting to see several experiences where individuals came into those organizations and were able to turn those organizations around in surprisingly short order. And it didn't involve any fancy statistics. It didn't involve any, you know, new theories or you know, something they learned at graduate school. it involved just basic leadership, people taking charge and inspiring the other folks within that organization to do better at whatever it was the organization did. In your pamphlet here, your sheet here, raising a graduate, every one of those individual points you put on there pertains to leadership in one aspect or another. And it's, I guess, in my experience, in an educational organization, the primary leader is going to be the teacher in the classroom. And some teachers come to the job with a certain amount of leadership ability, and some don't. And you know, those of us that deal with teachers know who have those strong leadership characteristics and who are lacking. What is the Department of Education doing basically to increase the leadership abilities of all the teachers in your organization? One thing, you know, a good leader is going to do is going to raise the expectations of the people that they are leading, in this case the students. I've always found that if you simply in the course of your day-to-day operations, if you expect high standards, simply expect it. People will rise to the occasion. And at some point, the responsibility for education, you know, we can throw a lot of money at this and go nowhere. But if we can change the psychology of and the attitudes that pertain to our educational system and the expectations that we have to do that through the leadership of classroom teachers. What is the Department of Education doing to help raise the leadership skills of your teachers?
To the chair, Representative Feige, we do have a teacher mentoring program, which is part of our state system of support. That focuses on new teachers in first year. Maybe even we have some second year
teachers.
Yeah. It's we don't quite have the capacity to expand that beyond some targeted areas. We do have some mentoring going on also for administrators. But the teacher mentoring program, we'd be happy to share some information on how that's gone. Still relatively new, 3 or 4 years been doing it?
Longer than that.
Is it longer than that?
Yes, it is.
Okay. But we can certainly share that. I'm not as actively involved in the teacher mentoring. I think you're ready to say something.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, a lot of this goes back to teacher preparation, working with the institutions that prepare teachers to help them understand what their role is in a classroom, in a community. As you may be aware, 75% of our teachers still come from outside. Mm-hmm. So then it becomes incumbent upon the state and the districts to help those teachers that come from elsewhere understand what their role is through professional development. So there are professional development opportunities for teachers. As Eric mentioned, the teacher mentor program works with early career teachers, but also when the mentors go into a building, they're experienced teachers from Alaska. They are available to work with other teachers in the building also, helping them to reach a level where they too have high standards. Our principal coaching project helps early career administrators and superintendents become the educational leaders that are necessary if our students are going to become the people that they want to become. There are a variety of things. I don't have a list of them. I could get you a list of what we're doing if you would like. And remembering that each individual district has things that they're doing to meet what their students need also. So we have things going on at statewide level and then things that individual districts are doing.
I had a couple of thoughts. Before we even got together this morning, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, with the meetings that you were having under the Commissioner Ledoux that he had ordained, my thought was, were you about to come to a conclusion? Do you feel like you came to a conclusion? If there were more meetings, would they be really productive? Where were you in the continuum of, you know, having explored, and then you feel like you got closure on that whole subject of dropout?
Chair Dick, I feel, and I think Eric would probably agree with me, that this is not something that you're going to come to closure on in a series of 8 to 10 meetings. Mm-hmm. We would like the opportunity to work with Commissioner Hanley to see what his focus would be for this work, and he brings in ideas that we haven't had a chance to explore yet from his perspective. So I know that the people on the committee weren't ready to stop. They don't feel like closure is there at the doorstep. So I think I could give you more information on that after we've had a chance to work with Commissioner Hanley on this.
Well, as I attended that last meeting, I felt like there was great stuff happening. That was kind of a loaded question because I like to see the meetings continue myself. There's a real sense of expectation, but I didn't have any sense of closure. So, also, there's been a couple of requests for information, and any information that's been requested, if you just get that to me, I'd make sure the whole committee gets that information. As we look at dropout rates, we don't want to focus on the negative. But if we look at the U.S. Constitution, you know, the colonies realized that they were under very, in their case, it was a negative situation, and they knew exactly what they didn't want. So, and I believe we have the best Constitution that we could ever have. So, as we're looking at the dropout rate and the reasons for dropouts, we're not trying to be negative about that. We're just trying to look at what's going on so we can come up, again, the best strategy we can have. One thought that I've had for a long time is that all over Alaska, we're so scattered. And in many places, the role models, like if you live in Anchorage, there's role models everywhere. You go into the bank, you go into the sports arena, there's everywhere you go, there's role models that you could run into. If you want to get into the dog mushers, there's associates, there's everywhere you can turn. But in some of the more remote places, many of the role models aren't available at all. One thing I'd like to see would be and all the young people are into YouTube, maybe a 5 to 10 minute interviews with maybe young people 18 to 28 that have succeeded. And that success could even be you won the Yukon 500 boat race. You know, that it's not necessarily, you know, you became a legislator. If we could get, I'd love to see hundreds of videos. Every morning a teacher could click on, you know, a young person saying, okay, this is what I did, and you know, I might have left the area, but I'm succeeding now, I made these mistakes, I had these assumptions, and just some real life interviews so that we could constantly put those positive role models in front of the students so that if somebody wants to be an athlete, that they have the Alaskan person who succeeded as an athlete, or somebody wants to be a veterinary assistant. Well, there might not be one in your village, but here's one who did succeed at that. And I know the ANSEP program at UAA has wonderful role models there, and I've actually interviewed a few, and if the committee will bear with me, I might even show a video that I put together with interviewing those young people and why, who they are and where they're going and why they want to do that. But those role models don't exist in the villages or even in any small community. So I think that'd be a huge component for just inspiring the young people, engaging again, to get them involved and seeing, well, if they can do it, I can do it. So I'd like to talk with you after a bit as to how we can make that happen. I don't think it's the fiscal note on that isn't big at all. We don't have to get YouTube, if the camera jiggles, it looks like it's we did it. You know, it's like, we, you know, it doesn't have to be professionally done. What we really need to do is just get the young people that they can identify with, and just saying, I've done it, and you can too. So, Representative Sisna.
I hate to jump in here, but I agree, and I think that's a good idea. The technology is out there. Groups around rural Alaska are doing a much more comprehensive job with video teleconferencing than we need to. But what that means is they're oftentimes very, very competent at using the technology, and in very rural places, which is really rather surprising.
Just ask my 10-year-old.
Excuse me, what was that?
Just ask my 10-year-old.
Exactly. We can all watch the real young guys, but actually the Health Caucus did a video teleconference from Galena to, in fact, this room right here in the energy conference that school held, and we had six rural, much smaller communities than Galena, talking about what the energy costs were doing, and gave that information back here. It wasn't as polished as what the chair sounds like he's thinking of. There are there's a group out of Kodiak that have been working with Nikolai, and they won a film contest just months ago, and it's talking about that. It's actually having the kids in the school interviewing their community and highlighting some of the history of their community. It's really targeted at trying to get at some of the social problems, is exactly what they were doing in that film. But it's going to be nationwide that one is shown. So, and that's just going to the school in Nikolai and working in that school. We could create an invitation on some of these issues to have students present things to us, I think, through you. I mean, I think that's a possibility. That's for this committee to maybe even invite. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that's an idea thrown out.
Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Seaton.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that, of course, we've looked at really intently is student engagement with individuals. And one of the things on teacher certification, we have teachers that have taught in the past, have retired, have let their credential lapse, have areas of expertise. I know in the Kenai Peninsula, we have the natural resources classes are now being canceled. And they're being canceled because to have the people with the expertise come in and teach the class, the certification is saying, oh, you have to go back and take a year's worth of courses, even though you had a certificate, to be able to teach the class, instead of the 6 years re-up, you know, for a specific continuing education. So I'm wondering whether the teacher certification section here has looked at, do some of our requirements actually limit our ability to have the student engagement, and what is there anything that we statutorily need to do, or is it through regulation that would enhance the ability of career tech, vocational tech, those kind of expertise? Of course, you have to pass a background check and all those kind of things, but is there other ways in which we can make changes to get those resources into our classroom, and especially if people have had a certificate in the past, can actually conduct the class instead of, you know, having two people in a classroom and tying up all the resources. And you may not have the answer to that right now, but I would sure like to get it back, because I think we're seeing that loss of expertise, not only in my community, but in communities across the state. And so, appreciate that.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, in specific with regard to career and technical education, there is a Type M certification that a person could get, but it is in the areas of vocational education, JROTC, I'm sorry, and the Alaska Native Language and Culture. So there could be a possibility to look at maybe another type of certificate for someone who has, who meets the criteria that you're talking about, that's already been prepared as a teacher, had a teacher certificate before, that sort of thing. So I can look into that with teacher certification, and then we can get you some information about that.
Appreciate that.
Thank you. I've heard that from several places, too. It seems to be some enthusiasm behind that idea. Sure. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Cindy, with the working group, did you have any instructors from the university there listening in and taking part?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, Saichi Oba, who works with the University of Alaska statewide, was there representing the university, and he has an excellent grasp on what is going on throughout the university system, and helped us to understand, I hesitate to use the term, where the university was coming from, but the realities of that. We didn't have university faculty per se on the committee to let us know what their expectations were, if that's what your question is.
Follow up. And the reason I ask that question is because a lot of people that teach in universities have been there for many, many years, and the classroom setting and what kids experience today are absolutely totally different than when they were in school. And if we don't change the way they are teaching teachers, kids or students to become teachers, we will fail. Now, I know that 75% of our teachers come from the lower 48, but at least we should be making sure that we're right on with what we're teaching the 25% that are here and that are going to stay here. So I think that conversation really needs to be taking place between K-12 and the university.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the Teacher Quality Committee, one of its subtopics is to look at teacher preparation programs and to work with those folks. So on the Teacher Quality Committee, there are people from the university, and there are conversations going on about the way we prepare our teachers and things that need to be done.
Thank you.
Representative Feige.
And to follow up on both Representative Seaton and Representative Wilson, one thing I guess if you could consider, I don't need you to come back with a list of everything, but consider which subjects actually need a certified teacher to teach, especially in the vocational and technical arenas. You know, it's going to be very difficult to find certified industrial arts teachers, especially in a small rural community. They may not have the existing shop facilities, but there may be somebody in town who knows basic mechanics, who knows carpentry, who knows how to operate heavy equipment. And I'm not saying that, you know, we start training programs in every single village utilizing the local help, but at least these people could be brought in to provide an introduction, to provide maybe a little more relevance for some of these students that, you know, it's one thing to be taught by somebody who went to college, but if you really don't want to go to college and you really want to learn what's going on in the real world, the rest of the world. So it'd be nice to have those opportunities for students to be exposed to those people in a classroom setting.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, when I referred to the Type M certification in the vocational trades, that allows a district who has an expert in mechanics or welding or innumerable vocational areas to be able to get that person certified in order to teach the class. That doesn't mean they had to have gone to college. The Type M is for people who have not completed baccalaureate teacher preparation but have the skills, the content knowledge, to be able to teach students in those areas.
Representative Pruitt.
I think you might have actually answered a little bit of it. I was going to ask if there were statutes, whether federal or state, that prevent the opportunity to allow some of those people that might not have had the degrees to be in a classroom setting. So I think you kind of hit on that, though.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, back in the day, as my daughter would say, there was a recognition that there were people who could provide instruction who hadn't gone to college. Our recognized experts in Alaska Native language and culture, the JROTC, the vocational trades, and so those people are allowed through both statute and regulation to be able to teach in classrooms. The district has the person, and then they help them get the certification.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Oh, Representative Seaton.
I guess I have one more, and we touched you and others eloquently on some of the cultural differences. And I would like to get back from the department what the strategy for education is. I mean, we've identified that some of the things were that there's a cultural almost imperative not to plan for the future. Mm-hmm. There's a cultural, in one of our broad mixes of cultures, I'm not sure about the others, that you observe and you don't vocalize. If your home training is that you're supposed to not be vocalizing and talking, what is the strategy by the Department of Education to work within a community to either, without saying we're going to come in and we're going to change your culture, but if we want to have education and we're going to do it in the mix that we've seen across the state, those things are imperative to have a strategy of how to work with those, as well as the differences between, you know, when you're a young person in the village, and Mr. Hensley has told us this on numerous occasions, you know, that until you're 20, you keep your mouth shut. When you get, you know, 20 to 40, you can say a few things. When you're older, then you'll be talking and sharing, and everybody will be listening. I mean, that's the so without destroying a culture, mm-hmm, and cultural ways of doing things, what is the strategy that the Department of Education has for engaging and being able to, you know, modify the way we educate or the way it's received so that we don't have we're not butting heads and we can move forward and people can still have the choice of their culture as whether they want to leave a village or whether they want to stay in a village. And it seems to me that those are highly significant things that we need a true strategy, not just we'll deal with them later. And I'm not saying that that's your strategy now, but I think that with as much as we've talked on these points today, we really need to come forward with that. If the department has the integrated strategy to accomplish that, it would be good for us to know about that so that we're not, you know, talking out of left field, and we can also see whether the committee agrees that the strategy is going to accomplish the goal.
If I could speak to that, too, I worked for the Alaska Rural Systemic Initiative for a decade, and the Alaska Native Knowledge Network has lots of the information that we're speaking about. But unfortunately, with teacher turnover the way it is, you can train the folks that are there today, and you have to do that all over again. So, you know, we have to, the information is there. I think the classic example that I ever heard of was down around Bethel, where the teacher asked the student a question, and the student respectfully put her head down and answered, you know, but the teacher, wanting eye contact, which implied respect, you know, said, look me in the eye. Well, the student respectfully put her eyes down and ended up with the teacher with her thumbnail, look me, you know, give me respect. She was demanding respect of that, you know, from that native student, and the native student was just desperately trying to give respect by looking down. That's a classic example. It comes out of the 30s and 40s, but it just shows how intuitively we can think we're doing the right thing and be doing exactly the wrong thing. I believe the information is there, and somehow if we can get that, because I believe now every teacher, in order to teach in Alaska, has to have a course in Alaska studies. But I'm not sure that how much of that anymore has to do with cross-cultural issues. So, yeah, and I know even as I've been in the village, I understood the way, and then I left for 3-4 years. I went back, and I found myself doing things that were intuitively wrong again. So even if we've known these things, it's easy to forget them, and it takes a while to reconnect. And in the meantime, you might be alienating a student. You might be offending somebody without even knowing it. So it's good we're aware of that, but how to get that to every teacher of all the 7,000 teachers that are entering the classroom every day, how we can communicate that to them. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's important for us to realize that in the Anchorage schools alone, they speak 100 different languages. And so it's not just in villages. It's everywhere, you know. And this is a real challenge, because how do you try to figure out every culture and try to deal with it? And so, you know, we've got our work cut out for us because of that, because, you know, it's not just in certain areas. It's everywhere. And I'm hoping that the new commissioner just comes in and is so excited, and he's got all kinds of new ideas that we haven't heard before. So,
okay. Any other questions? Okay. Any other comments?
Mr. Chairman, I did want to respond to both Representative Seaton and Representative Wilson. We do have a director of rural education in our department, and she has participated, Phyllis Carlson, who's participated in our graduation recruit meetings, and that position was created to address those exact issues. And so we can certainly get back to the department with Ms. Carlson and discuss what our strategy is. Mm-hmm. Did want to mention that.
Thank you. This has been, I don't know, for me it's been energizing, because this is where our heart really is, you know, of all the budgets and everything else. I don't care. This is what I think this is where the rubber meets the road, and I think your position is most important. And I'm thrilled that you're both there, because I know we can certainly work together. So we're going to take a brief at ease, and then Representative Sisna will come back and.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
You said you'd be ready. Do you want to? Do you want to pass?
Yeah, you're asking. I will do it.
Thank you, dear. Okay. A brief at ease, that she's going to come back and give the summary of the answer to the 6 questions that we all answered that she was not here for.
Thank you very
okay.
much.
Okay. Brief at ease. And in respect for other people's schedules and need to be somewhere at 10 o'clock, we'll adjourn at 10:55. So, Representative Sisna, 15 minutes of your background. I know you've paddled the rivers trying to explore and find out about our state and our schools and our villages. So, we'd like to hear from you.
Well, I'm going to start with the fact that the reason I'm new on this committee, I've not been on the Education Committee before, was because health is more important to me, and it's more important to me personally. Education is extraordinarily important, but health more, because I was one of those people who was born dying. And I had severe allergies. At 6 months, my parents were told that I would not make it. and they, this was World War II in Seattle, and they found a doctor in Moscow, Idaho. This is an amazing story that I'm not going to go into completely, but mother went there on a military train, and with this crying baby, I was raw with rashes. It was starving to death because nothing would stay down. And this doctor in Moscow had worked out a formula for babies with allergies, with extreme allergies. He was too old to be drafted by the military, and that was the big problem, was the military had taken all the doctors in Seattle that might have known something about allergy. But this man was too old, and so he hadn't been scooped up by the military. And mother got me in, got a sample of the formula. It worked right away, and a salve that started working right away. Went back in the next day for consultation and for him to give her the formula outline or the contents, and he had died during the night. So she went back on that military train and took the samples to the pharmacist, and they rebuilt it as close as they could, and that's what kept me alive. That's so I've always owed something to health. It seems like a subject I need to do something about. Obviously, I lived, and so I actually went to kindergarten, and probably I think my allergies, which weren't cured, but they were there, probably did interfere with me as a great student. I was one of those students that really never quite got there and struggled through elementary school, struggled through, elementary school went right into high school at that point. And in high school, I was getting better and better, had fewer and fewer problems. So we're starting my experience in school, and we're talking about my experience in education. Well, first of all, one of my different experiences in education was that my father was a brilliant man. He was an attorney, but he'd started several things, a steamship company that came here to Alaska that he had for several years, and then he sold that and he started an insurance company, and that's what I grew up essentially in. Our dog was called Federal Line Life Insurance Company, and Fed for short. But anyway, Dad was one of those people who was constantly looking at what was going on. He had spent many years in school. He worked his way through school, through law school. He was the only person in his class that was working full time while taking the training and at the University of Washington, and was told there was no way he could do it. He did it. He did not get high grades, but he was one of the top in the law exam, the bar exam. Yes, he was one of the top students in terms of the grade in the bar exam. He thought, when he started hearing about computers, and this would have been right around in 1952, that his kids should know how to type, because that was obviously going to be the future. And that he thought especially his son should know how to type, but I was 2 years younger, and why not send Sharon too? And so I spent one summer at age 12 in a business school learning how to type. So that's a little different than most people would experience in that age range. So I've been typing since age 12. The next kind of almost different kind of school that I went to was as dad matured and mother matured in their business life, they felt that Sharon was really a little bit not polished enough for this successful business family. So they were going to send me to a finishing school that had a very great reputation. But my grades weren't really great, so they started pushing me, and I pushed back. So my grades in my junior year of high school dropped down to very low. And in between my junior and senior year of high school, I went to a music camp where I actually met Sid Atwood, who you may now know that I recently married. And so that's kind of a fun thing. But the other part of that was it was at Washington State University, and I suddenly realized what I was doing to myself. I suddenly personalized the battle over the school issue and realized that the next step was going to be college or no college, and that college was a wildly exciting idea. And I had not gotten that until that experience in a summer camp. That's one that works in this committee. And so in my senior year, I killed myself. And I brought my grade point average up to 2.0. And it was a lot of work to do that. So I'm one of the people who is really going to identify with the kids that have had a real tough time. I came from a wealthy family, but I grew up feeling that what I wanted to do was to be a common person, that I wanted to have an average or maybe a low income average. And I have succeeded beyond belief. So that's the early part. And I still have five more minutes.
Seven
more minutes. Then after that, I went to Washington State University, went back to there, and political and other reasons had my dad kind of think I needed to work my way through school myself. And so what I realized was in working my way through school, if I was going to do it successfully, what I had to do was have above entry-level income. So it was absolutely mandatory for me to go back to business school. And I got a degree in, well, it wasn't a degree, it was a certificate in basic office skills. And I was able to raise the amount of money that I was able to make. And I did, in fact, go out and I worked my way through school. So I not only finished bachelor's, which took me 12 years to get, in 2 years I was able to get my master's in counseling psychology, and as a legislator, in my first year we had our first $1 billion shortfall. I immediately went back to Washington, or to the University of UAA, pardon me, tried for a master's in public administration. I found that I could not finish that and be here. I could have quit here and gotten done in very short order. I didn't quit. I've been here steadily, and I only have half of a public administration, but enough to know some of the questions to ask and know when we're headed wrong. And so that's been a real aid to me here. So I'm one of these people who's seen the trade school and the university. And to this point, because of my years, counseling was there, and that was for 12 years. but for 27 years I had a publication business. It was a successful business. It did everything I needed that business to do. And as a result of that experience, what I know is that the education is very important. Experience is more important. And you've got to be able to get both of those pieces in at the right place. And that timing is not the critical issue. It's sticking with it. It's making sure that we bring people in whenever we can capture them. It's very similar to all of the other kinds of problems that humans have. And at this age, at 68 going on 69, 50 years, this is my 50th year in the workforce. What I know is both social problems and employment problems take slow time for some people. Some of us have had a hard enough road. It isn't going to come to us easily. It's making sure that we're there for people when they're ready. And all we have to do is look at where we are in the status nationally, comparing us to other states. You know that Alaska has a lot of challenges. And what we have to do is realize that our people are amazing people. All you have to do is go to the 64 communities I've gone to and plan to go to many more. And what you see is every single place talent, every single place ideas and real efforts to try to bring themselves into a better place. And what I know from my experience is if we're there for them, if we stretch ourselves, we can do it. We can do it as a state, and we can become the kind of state we need to. I think that's good. I think that brings it to a close. Is that good? All right? Oh, any questions?
Excellent. Any questions from the committee? Like any questions, next Monday meeting, we're going to have a presentation on the Alaska Career and Technical Education Plan. Which to me right now is just an acronym, and by Monday we'll all be on top of it. So meeting will be adjourned until next Monday. Did I miss something? Adjourned until next Monday.
Which did?